For those who haven't heard Dr. Simkowitz speak yet, she is she teaches at the Catholic Theological Union in Chicago, the one Jew on campus almost. That's very interesting. Got her PhD in Brandeis on Second Temple literature and rabbinic Judaism, degree from Harvard, a graduate of Stern. And she's living in Chicago with her husband and four kids. So I think that's all the main points, the most important points. And a pleasure having you on the weekend. Bakasha. Solomon Schachter on the discovery of the Cairo Geniza.
All right, does everybody have a source sheet? I think that there are some over there on that table if you need. Good morning, and we'll get this set up in a minute. Thank you for your help. In the 1880s and 1890s, there were two major developments that were occurring in the field of biblical scholarship, and these developments converged into the story that I'm going to tell you today. The first development is the field of biblical criticism that was expanding in Germany among scholars who were primarily Protestant, scholars such as Julius Wellhausen and Bernard Jume. These scholars were beginning to look at the Bible in a new way, in a way that argued that God did not write every word of the Bible. And Wellhausen developed a very sophisticated, very complex argument that we now call the documentary hypothesis. This argument is that the Pentateuch had four different authors, J, E, P, and D. I'm not going to go into this now. And this took off and basically gave rise to a whole new field of biblical study. The issue is that the undercurrent of this field was rife with anti-Jewish sentiments. So while these scholars were doing this work, they were at the same time disparaging the Hebrew Bible as being inferior to the New Testament. They argued that the Jewish religion was sputtering and coming to a halt in the first century, that it was approved upon and universalized by the Christian religion, that the God of Israel, the God of the Hebrew Bible, was a vengeful God. Could we actually have a light on? Because everyone's going to go to sleep, including me. Good. Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you. Thanks. Okay, and I do want to get it. All right, I'll work on this later. That the God of the Hebrew Bible is a vengeful God, a jealous God, a petty God, but that the God that Jesus represented was the true, higher, universal, enlightened God. And so when these Bible scholars begin to work on the Hebrew Bible, there is an undercurrent that the Hebrew Bible has less theological worth than the text of the New Testament. And so this is one development that's occurring in the 1880s and 1890s. At the same time, we're dealing with a burgeoning of treasure hunting all over the Levant, all over the Mediterranean world. This is the world of British colonization, and this is the time when scholars from all over Europe are essentially pillaging ancient sites along the coast of the Mediterranean looking for treasure, but not for any trivial reason. They are trying to prove that their own biblical history stands firm. And so scholars and also lay people would go to Egypt, they would go to what's now Iraq, Iran, Israel, Syria, and there was no legal system in place for making the pillaging of these sites illegal. You could go to any of these sites, you might find a little ancient animal bone from a sacrifice 2,000 years ago. You might find a little Asherah goddess that was worshipped 3,000 years ago. You might find, if you were lucky, an ancient text written on papyrus, written on leather, and you would just take it home. You could donate it to your local university library, and that's how the University of Cambridge acquired a number of its treasures. Or you could keep it. Or, if you were smart, you could sell it on the black market. And so this idea that looking for artifacts and searching for treasure was a totally legitimate pursuit that scholars were engaged in, it came to a head really in the 1890s. And it's in this context that the Cairo Geniza is discovered. But before I go to the Cairo Geniza and Solomon Schachter's role in it, I want to talk a little bit more about where people were looking for ancient manuscripts. The fact of the matter is, most ancient manuscripts were being preserved very carefully and very assiduously by monasteries. In the medieval period, monks were literate. Most Christians were not. And in fact, although there was a higher literacy rate among the Jews, there were plenty of Jews who were not literate in the medieval period. Again, the literacy rate is higher. But the Jews were not copying Second Temple Jewish texts that were not regarded as rabbinic. Of course, they were studying and copying Mishnah, rabbinic literature, Midrash, Talmud, right? But the texts that Jews were writing in the Second Temple period that are now part of this nebulous collection that scholars called the pseudepigrapha, so texts that are not in Tanakh and not in the rabbinic canon, but very valuable in terms of shedding light on Jewish history in the Second Temple period, so from 515 BCE to 70 CE, these texts like you might have heard of Jubilees or Enoch, the Testaments of the 12 Patriarchs, these are all Jewish texts that are extremely, extremely valuable actually now in its importance in the Christian tradition, but they were written by Jews within Jewish context and by Jews who really viewed themselves as adhering to the ancestral tradition. So this is a very bizarre anomaly in the study of the transmission of history and religion, that these Jewish texts were preserved for centuries, primarily in monasteries. Now, if I had made a PowerPoint, next time I'll come back and give this exact lecture and I'll give a PowerPoint, I would show you a picture now of a Greek island. It's actually a peninsula. It's called Mount Athos. Mount Athos was populated in the 9th century by monks, and now it has about 20 monasteries. And on Mount Athos, even today, the treasures in those libraries are beyond anything that exists anywhere in the world, and those treasures include both artifacts and manuscripts, and many of these are Jewish. Many, many. It doesn't necessarily mean that these monks were pillaging synagogues. It means that they got a hold of many manuscripts and copied them. With the artifacts, you're dealing with a much trickier question of how these came to become the property of monasteries. This is a field that's emerging. We know very little about how these texts and why these texts were preserved. But on Mount Athos, we have many ancient manuscripts dating to as early as the 9th century. We also have, if you have heard of the Jewish Book of Enoch, there are monasteries all over North Africa that regard Enoch as scriptural and that keep ancient manuscripts of Enoch guarded 24/7 in the back rooms of their libraries. And so monasteries really became the place where ancient texts were stored. Now you need to know all of this to understand the import of finding something like the Geniza. And you also need to understand how important and what a long shadow biblical criticism cast for somebody like Solomon Schachter, who viewed himself as a total outsider to the world of academia. Here's a Romanian Jew. He knows about 6 or 7 languages. In the 1880s or 1890s, who goes to the University of Cambridge, is appointed a reader of rabbinics, is totally integrated in the world of academia, and yet views himself as a complete outsider. So when he gets wind of the existence of a storehouse in Fustat, Egypt, that contains hundreds of thousands of Hebrew manuscripts that were preserved by Jews, what's at stake here is enormous. Because what he tries to do and what he succeeds in doing is restoring the integrity of Jewish literary practice and development. Now, the example that I'm going to talk to you about is Ben Sira. Where's the mouse? Oh, okay, it's on the, I'm totally technologically. Okay, we're going to do that at the end. That's the fun stuff. Thank you. Thank you so much. We'll do that at the end. Okay. All right. In 1895, see, I'm starting again. New thought. In 1895, Schechter is at the University of Cambridge. He's teaching his rabbinic literature, and he's approached by two women. Two Scottish identical twin sisters. Stop me if you know the story. Do you know the story? Okay, great. Two identical twin sisters with an independent fortune and a mind of great curiosity. Agnes Smith Lewis and Margaret Dunlop Gibson. Thank you. Thank you so much. There's no test, but I'm going to say that again. Agnes Smith Lewis, Margaret Dunlop Gibson. Agnes Smith Lewis and Margaret Dunlop Gibson had something very good happen to them. This is really crude. Their husbands died. It's not good. But what it enabled them to do is it gave them, at a very young age, total independence, because they were living in a traditional society where women who were married were expected to have children and not have mobility. But coincidentally, these identical twin sisters came into a lot of money, were not tied down by children or spouses, and they committed themselves to educating themselves in as many biblical languages as possible. Now, when we think biblical languages, we just think Hebrew, but for these women, it's not just Hebrew. The Hebrew Bible was translated in the 3rd century BCE to Greek, the Septuagint. The Septuagint was translated in the 4th century by Jerome into Latin, that's the Vulgate. We have the Syriac version of the Bible, that's a dialect of Aramaic. So what the twin sisters did, what Agnes and Margaret did, is they self-educated themselves in 4 or 5 languages, and they traveled the Levant. They traveled the areas of the Mediterranean searching for ancient treasure. Now, this actually sounds like a lot of fun. One day I would like to do this. They go to Egypt, and they say, our only goal is to acquire ancient artifacts. They're devoutly religious. They're Presbyterian. As somebody who teaches in a Catholic school, now I know the Presbyterian church is really, I shudder a little bit because they're very, very vehemently anti-Israel, and some might argue anti-Semitic. I'm sure these women were very nice, and we're not going to impose our modern anti-Presbyterian stereotypes on them. Lovely women. But devoutly religious. And of course, there is a motivation here to find ancient texts that affirm their strong religious convictions. They go to Cairo, and in the marketplace, there are many people who are selling different ancient artifacts to British passersby. At this time, Egypt was under the colonization of the British Empire, and it was very hard to know if you were dealing with an artifact that is forged. Are you okay? You have a question? Because you're okay. Feel free to raise your hand if you have any questions. If I'm not being clear. It's hard to know if someone says, oh, look, buy this ancient manuscript. You know, the average person would not know. Is this real? What is it? What am I looking at? Is this a forgery? Should I pay for it? Should I not? An artifact, a papyrus, a leather a scroll, a manuscript. It was a hard thing to be able to evaluate. Am I dealing with something real? Somebody approaches them with an ancient Hebrew fragment. They buy it. They're not sure if it's valuable or not. It could be total garbage. But they buy it. They buy many, many other things, too. They go to Palestine, Israel. They go in between Egypt and Israel. They travel a little bit in the Sinai Desert. That's important because one of the oldest monasteries in the world is in the Sinai Desert. I don't know if you've heard of St. Catherine's Monastery. It has many, many treasures there. They end up finding the oldest Bible in existence, the Syriac Sinaiticus, 4th century CE. The oldest Bible with the New Testament. So in their minds, it was the oldest Bible. This actually ended up earning Agnes Smith Lewis an honorary doctorate and made her extremely, extremely famous in her lifetime that she found this at St. Catherine's. But they get this little tiny piece of scroll with Hebrew on it. They know that it's Hebrew, but They don't know what it's from. They don't know if it's valuable. After a month or so of traveling, they go back to Cambridge and they say, we really need somebody to look at this fragment. The only person who's really an expert in rabbinic literature is somebody that we've heard of, but we don't know personally. His name is Solomon Schechter. In 1896, they go to Schechter's office, and they say, we have this little fragment. We found it in Cairo, Egypt. We want to know what you think about it. Schechter looks at this fragment, and he almost passes out. He talks about the moment at which he sees this fragment, and his whole world falls away. This is the greatest moment of his life. He's shaking. He's shuddering. He is overwhelmed with the greatest joy. What was this fragment? This was a Hebrew version of Ben Sira. A Hebrew fragment of Ben Sira had never been found. Ben Sira, or Ecclesiasticus in English, is part of the Catholic Bible. It is preserved in the Apocrypha. It is scripture to Catholics, not to Protestants, because the Apocrypha, the books of the Apocrypha, are not in the Protestant Bible, and obviously not in the Hebrew, the Jewish Bible. But because the rabbis quote Ben Sira, many scholars, including Jews, believed that Ben Sira was at some point, at least by some Jews, regarded as scriptural or authoritative, maybe not cemented in the Hebrew Bible, in the canon, but still of great religious value. Ben Sira is one of those very, very few extra-canonical books that is cited in the Talmud. Scholars in Germany in the 1880s and 1890s had been co-opting Ben Sira and saying, we are not convinced that this book ever existed in Hebrew. Yes, we know the rabbis quote verses that look like it might have been from Ben Sira. Maybe they were translating a Greek version that they had, but Ben Sira was written by a Hellenized Jew who only knew Greek. It reflects a genre of wisdom literature that the rabbis were not familiar with. No rabbinic Jew who knew Hebrew would have written Ben Sira. It's way too philosophical and lofty. The Christian scholars at the end of the 19th century had co-opted Ben Sira into their own tradition. And this was a troubling trend that had been happening not only regarding Ben Sira, but regarding other Jewish books written in the late Second Temple period. Have you heard of the Book of Enoch? The Book of Enoch is a Jewish text, Second Temple, co-opted by the Christian tradition. Medieval manuscripts of Enoch have references to the Trinity and to Jesus, but even older manuscripts of Enoch don't have those references. It's an entirely Jewish book. Okay. I'm now going to share with you a little passage from Shaya Cohen. He's a professor at Harvard University. He wrote a classic book on Second Temple Judaism. Maybe you've heard of it, from the Maccabees to the Mishnah. There's a paragraph out here that I think helps us understand what was at stake when Schechter found proof that there is an ancient Hebrew version. And by the way, they did confirm this was not a forgery. This is actually an ancient fragment of Ben Sira. When he found out that there was proof, it's important to remember that these devoutly religious Christian scholars truly thought that Judaism was sputtering to an end by the end of the First Temple period. Judaism was a shell of itself. It was particularistic. It had lost its ethical values. It had lost its way. The Pharisees, the Sadducees that you read about in the New Testament are corrupt moneylenders. They're not empathetic. They just care about the law. They're legalistic. They're particularistic. Judaism had no internal value. It was just legalism, and Christianity redeemed it and improved it. And by the way, this is why Jewish Bible scholars today feel so strongly about undermining biblical criticism. I don't know if you were at the panel last night, but there's a lot at stake here besides just the question of who wrote the Bible. That's a big question, of course. But there's also an undercurrent of anti-Jewish sentiment when it comes to the oldest scholarship on biblical criticism. Now, I want to read you, this is a little bit of story time, but he's such a good writer that I think I can keep your attention. And if I can, then we can blame it on Shaya Cohen. 19th century scholars, I'm reading from the Maccabees to the Mishnah, 19th century scholars, especially in Germany, used the term late Judaism, Spätjudentum, to designate the religion and society of the Jews after Ezra or after the Maccabees. the term disparaged and was meant to disparage the Judaism it designated. The Judaism of the Second Temple period was late because it was approaching the end of its appointed time and was about to relinquish to Christianity whatever value it retained. Late Judaism was a sterile, lifeless organism, waiting in vain for the infusion of spirituality that only Christianity could provide. After the birth of Christianity, late Judaism lost all importance and could be ignored by scholars and Christians alike. So I'll be honest with you, even when I teach my Catholic students, they know that I'm Jewish, they know that there are Jews out there, they know that there's a land of Israel, but the idea that I'm living as a rabbinic Jew, it's very surprising to them. The idea that Judaism is a living religion based on rabbinic Judaism, some of them don't quite get that because they kind of do think that rabbinic Judaism sputtered to an end before early Christianity improved on it. I'm going back to Cohen now. The fact that Judaism continued to flourish and develop for millennia after the period of late Judaism did not affect the currency of the term. In other words, when you hear scholars say the term late Judaism and they're talking about the first century, you should be offended. Because there's a real theology there of supersessionism. And I try to tell my students that even the most innocent terms, Old Testament implies there's a New Testament, late Judaism implies it came to an end. It's really important what vocabulary we use, what terminology we use. Okay, so he says late Judaism did not affect the currency of the term because the term derived not from historical analysis but from theological belief. That's Shaya Cohen, one of the greatest scholars of Second Temple Judaism, out there today. Okay. So Schechter sees this tiny little text of Ben Sira, of Ecclesiasticus, and he knows, I have got to find out where this came from. So much is at stake. The whole idea that Jews were rabbinic Jews and yet writing wisdom, philosophical literature, and that that was integrated in the world of proto-rabbinic Judaism, and it shouldn't be co-opted by the Christians. It's actually a very Jewish, pious book. He had to find out where this came from. So he goes to Egypt in December 1896. Now, we have to remember this is a dangerous trip in 1896. It takes a long time. And he doesn't tell anybody. He keeps it top secret. But I found in some obscure articles copies of letters that he wrote to some friends. So he doesn't publish anything until he comes back. But I'm going to tell you again on a personal level, I feel kind of proud that I came upon this. So just going to do some bragging. There, I'm done. Okay. So in 1896, he has some correspondence with a friend of his in Philadelphia, a judge named Mayor Sulzberger. This is a personal friend. And the correspondence between Sulzberger and Schechter is preserved. The letters were saved and published in the early 20th century. I found this in a basement, in like a sub-basement, in a library at Garrett Theological Seminary, right next to Northwestern University. This is where I found this. Okay. So this is what Schechter says. This is in May 1896. He's just found the fragment of Ben Sira. He has not gone. Remember, he doesn't go down to Egypt until December. I met yesterday with a piece of good fortune of which many a biblical scholar will be jealous. I have namely, now he's writing in English, by the way. This was like his sixth language, and beautiful English. I've namely discovered among the fragments with which Mrs. Lewis, the discoverer of the Syriac Gospel, remember I told you that at St. Catherine's she found the 4th century Syriac copy of the Bible in the New Testament, the oldest Bible ever. So she's famous. She's well known in Cambridge. The fragments that she brought from her last journey in the Orient, a leaf from the Hebrew Sirach, as you know, was the original of the Apocrypha, that he's talking about the Apocrypha in the Hebrew. And the Gaonim even cite passages from it. But it is now for the first time we have a fragment coming from the body of the book. In other words, we had quotations, but we never actually had the book. So nobody really knew if it was originally written in Hebrew. A lot is at stake. I am now transcribing the MS, that's manuscript, and shall have Im Yirtzeh Hashem, very firm. By the way, you know, we think of Schechter as associated with the conservative movement, but he kept the mitzvos. He was from God-fearing person. I shall, God willing, write a monograph on the subject, which I hope you will receive soon. This is very enigmatic. I got this thing. I think it's Ben Sirach. I don't know where it's from. He's pretty vague. And he's vague because right now he doesn't have any information. He's just very, very excited about what he's seen. But then he publishes something in an academic journal that's no longer, it's out of publication. He publishes a facsimile. He publishes a copy of this fragment in a journal called The Expositor. And in The Expositor, he says something a little misleading. For this fragment, look at source two. We are indebted to Agnes Smith Lewis and Margaret Dunlop Gibson's last journey in Palestine and Egypt, in which countries they have acquired various Hebrew manuscripts, mostly in fragments. Our fragment was found in the Palestine bundle. Among other leaves of Hebrew manuscripts extending over various branches of Jewish literature as Bible, Mishnah, Talmud, liturgy, grammar, etc. Somebody made a mistake here, and the question is, was it intentional? What's the mistake? Palestine. The question is, was he trying to throw people off of his trail? How likely is it that Agnes Smith Lewis and Margaret Dunlop Gibson gave Schechter the wrong information, and why would they do that? They wanted him to look into this question of what this text is. They didn't have a stake in it. They didn't have any academic positions. So why would they mislead him and say it came from Palestine? It's more likely Schechter doesn't want people racing him to the finish. Let's look at what Schechter's wife, Matilda, says to Sulzberger in a letter. After Schechter, yes, you have a question? He's so excited, and he feels that it undermines everything that's being produced right now. It's 1896. This is when Wellhausen is producing article after article after article disparaging the Hebrew Bible. I think he felt an urgency, but he didn't want to give concrete information. That's my sense. Again, we're dealing with these little letters. We don't have Schechter here to ask, but this is really what I think. I think that he felt an urgency. He was so excited, but he definitely, and you'll see that Elkan Adler, who's a British collector of artifacts on the bottom of page 3, does race him. We're going to get there if we have time. So he does, and he does have Professor Taylor at University of Oxford. When he found out about the Gniza, he races to the Gniza. And there's a big rivalry between Taylor and Schechter. Big rivalry. Schechter knows a lot is at stake. He has to get to the Gniza ASAP. He goes to the Gniza. Matilda, I love her writings because she's... Okay, let's look at what she says to Sulzberger. Sulzberger must have written a letter to Schechter, and Matilda's telling Sulzberger, Schechter can't answer you right now because he's on a top secret mission. She's brimming with excitement, but she doesn't want to give information. Mr. Schechter left England on the 16th of December for the East, Egypt, and Palestine. He didn't go to Palestine, where he was sent to by our university for purposes of research, parentheses, Hebrew manuscripts. I love that. As it is a secret mission, she's so excited. The fact will be announced in the University Reporter only after the commencement of next term, about the end of January, when he will have already secured permission to work in the old Gniza. So she tells him it's a Gniza, but she doesn't say where, as otherwise his plans might have been defeated. So they can't say anything because his plans might be defeated, caused by his discovery of the Ecclesiasticus fragment. So he's talking about the Ecclesiasticus, the Ben Sira fragment. He's obviously told his wife, you can talk about that. He's published in the Expositor by the time he leaves in December. But he will not tell people where this is coming from. Yes?
Is this a fundraising letter?
Sulzberger
is a man of means, judge,
wealthy,
and inside.
I love it. They had personal correspondence for years. They were personal friends. It could be that she's trying to elbow in, you know, for some sort of volunteer donation. But this is coming on the heels of years of correspondence, so it is hard to know. Yeah, they corresponded for years. They were good friends, yes.
So these two sisters had bought this little piece of manuscript.
Yeah.
And bring it back to Schechter.
Yeah.
How did Schechter figure out that where he wanted to go with
Oh, they said, so they must have told him where to go. Exactly. That's why when he says is in the Palestine bundles, then how come he knows straight to go to Fastat? He goes straight to Fastat. Okay. Now, yes, and then I would like to go back. Yes, sure. Oh, okay. That's a great question. Okay. Right. So that's a great question. So I think that what happened is that the sisters got intel. But he doesn't know until he gets there. He goes, I'm going to get there. He goes to Fastat. He asks for the rabbi. There's this Ben Ezra synagogue. It's the oldest synagogue in Fastat, which is the old city of Cairo. He goes to Ben Ezra synagogue. He knows that this is, that they're probably going to have information on the ancient rabbinic manuscripts, but they give him the runaround for weeks until they show him where the Geniza is. Right. It's a question of whether he intuited this must have come from a Geniza or whether they said, we heard that there's a Geniza. But it's important to clarify, he doesn't discover the Geniza. The Jews in Egypt knew about the Geniza, and Elkan Adler knew about the Geniza. So some people on the inside knew about the Geniza. They didn't know the extent of what was in there, and they certainly hadn't emptied it out. And that's what Schechter achieves. Yeah. Good question. Okay. So again, so what Schechter ends up doing is allowing them to empty the entire contents of the Geniza, 250,000 fragments, to the University of Cambridge. So again, there were individuals who knew about the Geniza. Adler, Elkan Adler, never gave up his resentment of Schechter for getting the acknowledgement, because he did know about the Geniza. He visited the Geniza, but he didn't take anything. Well, he took a few thousand fragments from the Geniza, but he didn't publish about it. I know a few thousand sounds like a lot, but it's not. It's not when you compare it to 250,000. Okay. In an article called A Fragment of the Original Text of Ecclesiasticus, Schechter explains what's at stake. What is so important about proving that this Geniza, that this Ben Sira fragment is authentic, dated to the 2nd century BCE, and of a tradition that is exclusively part of the Jewish world. That these weren't assimilated Jews, Hellenized Jews. These were devout Jews adhering to ancestral tradition. What is at stake? If it could be proved that Sirach, some believe, in the rabbinic idiom, that means in the rabbinic literature it's called Sirach, the academics call it Ecclesiasticus. If it could be proved that Sirach, with which we are acquainted from the Talmudic literature, then between Ecclesiasticus and the books of the Old Testament, there must lie centuries, nay, there must lie, in most cases, the deep waters of the captivity, the exile, between 587 and 539 BC. In other words, this takes us back further in time to what Jewish life was like in the time of the exile, the grave of the old Hebrew and the old Israel, and the womb of the new Hebrew and the new Israel. In other words, this idea that Judaism died and then Christianity revived it and improved it will be undermined. The assumption of Maccabean Psalms and many other hypotheses of biblical criticism would fall to the ground. He just lays it out there. What are the Maccabean Psalms? Biblical scholars from the German Protestant school were arguing that some of the Psalms were written in the 2nd and 1st centuries BCE by people living under the Maccabean dynasty. What happens when you date Psalms to the 1st century BCE? That's what Bernard Doom does all the time. What happens when you're making those texts so late? You're putting them under an entirely different cultural context. And if you're at the same time arguing that Judaism is a shell of its former self at this time, well, it must be that something that's elegant and philosophical and part of the wisdom rubric of literature being produced in the first century, that psalm must be outside the confines of the rabbinic world. In other words, Schechter feels that his own literature, his own tradition, is being wrested away from him. And that's unacceptable. So he just lays it out there. This is what's at stake. Now I'm going to show you my favorite passage in the source sheet. In 1908, this is 12 years after Schechter sees the Geniza for the first time, he writes an article about his experience. By this time, the Geniza is emptied out. We have to read this line by line. I really try not to read sources line by line, but this is just too good. It's too good. There's nothing I could do about it. So in the beginning of this article, he talks about how he was cajoling the community of Fastat, the Jewish leaders of Fastat, to give him access to the Gniza. Now, traditionally, the Gniza, there was no public access to the Gniza. The rabbi and the beadle, the shamish, had access to the Gniza. Nobody else had access to the Gniza. In Fastat, in the Ben Ezra synagogue, there was a common room outside of the sanctuary, and there was a hole in the wall towards the ceiling. And if you wanted to get to the Gniza, you had to grab a ladder, put it against the wall, climb up this ladder, like 7 or 8 feet high, and then crawl into the hole, and that's the Gniza. So often, Gnizot are not as hard to get to. This Gniza is hard to get to. Schechter talks about how finally the rabbi, and there's a little bit of bribing involved, the rabbi allows him to take a peek at the Gniza, and he's not a young man at this point, and he's climbing up this rickety ladder, and then he just pokes inside. And by the way, Schechter, yes, please. Is there something? Oh, okay. Schechter probably had emphysema. He died in his 60s, probably because of the dust from all the texts that lay untouched for over 1,000 years, some of them, that he was dealing with, got into his lungs, and it's probably why he died a young person. What does he say? After showing me over the place and the neighboring buildings, or rather ruins, so he's at the Ben Ezra Synagogue in the old city of Cairo in Fustat, F-U-S-T-A-T, if you want to look it up, the Grand Rabbi of Cairo, Aaron ben Simon, introduced me to the beadles of the synagogue, who are at the same time the keepers of the Gniza, and authorized me to take from it what, and he had been here for weeks by now. He was making a relationship with them. He was trying to talk. This didn't happen overnight. This didn't happen the first day he got to Egypt. But he authorized me to take from it what and as much as I liked. This is one of the most famous lines that Schechter ever wrote in his life. Now, as a matter of fact, I liked it all. Probably the most famous thing he ever wrote. Still, some discretion was necessary. I have already indicated the mixed nature of the Gniza. But one can hardly realize the confusion in a genuine old Gniza until one has seen it. It is a battlefield of books, and the literary production of many centuries had their share in the battle, and their disjecta membra are now strewn over its area. This is unbelievable, right? Are you with me that this is, okay. Some of the belligerents have perished outright, so there's a battlefield of texts, and are literally ground to dust in the terrible struggle for space, while others, as if overtaken by a general crush, are squeezed into big, unshapely lumps, which even with the aid of chemical appliances can no longer be separated without serious damage to their constituents. In their present condition, these lumps sometimes afford curiously suggestive combinations. As, for instance, when you find a piece of some rationalist work in which the very existence of either angels or devils is denied, clinging for its very life to an amulet in which these same beings, mostly the latter, are bound over to be on their good behavior and not interfere with Miss Yair's, I don't know what that is, loves for somebody. So there are love letters and there are amulets and there are things that are denying the whole field of angelology, all mixed together. The development of the romance is obscured by the fact that the last lines of the amulet are mounted on some IOU or lease. And this, in turn, is squeezed between the sheets of an old moralist who treats all attention to money affairs with scorn and indignation. Again, all these contradictory matters cleave tightly to some sheets of a very old Bible. Now, you're all going to ask me a great question, so good job. The question is, I thought Gniza was only for religious texts. Good question, right? The idea that we store manuscripts, we don't store every single piece of paper. We throw out a lot, right? We only bury or put in a Gniza something with God's name on it, right? So why do we have copies of the Bible? We have responsa from Maimonides. We have contracts, leases, love letters, poems, P-U-T-M. How did this happen? How do we get a Gniza with 250,000 fragments that can be divided into so many genres? Look at the rest of the source sheet. Personal letters written by Maimonides, marriage contracts, texts that were used in divorce filings. P'utim by the great poet Yanai, who scholars knew about because he was referenced, but they didn't have one thing that he actually wrote until the Geniza was discovered. Karaite texts, medical prescriptions. How did this happen? It must be that the people who were storing these texts, which are, the majority of them are written in Hebrew, believed that the Hebrew language was so sanctified that anything written in Hebrew should not be thrown out. This is what scholars think. That it came to a point, most of these texts in the Geniza do not have God's name on it. Now again, there are legal responsa written by Maimonides in his own signature and personal letters to his brother. Maimonides was a trader who probably died in a shipwreck on the Indian Ocean. We have so much information about everything from the 9th century to the 19th century, most of it of not a foundationally religious nature. But the most likely answer is that the writing of Hebrew was regarded with special reverence in a way that we do not treat it today. Please. Right. This is what we think. I mean, why else would there be accounts of divorce proceedings put into the Geniza? Okay. So I think that this account of Schechter, of what he comes in and he calls this battlefield of books, is really unbelievable because there's no organization. And that means that when you walk into this Geniza or you crawl into it, it's a crawl space in an attic, you're seeing basically what the 9th and 10th and 11th century synagogue beadles were seeing. They're throwing things in and leaving. There was no catalog, no archive, no librarian. But what this also means, there's no archive. And by the way, the monasteries were very careful to have library archives. That means that the librarian, first of all, not only was literate, which was unusual in the medieval period, but also that the monastery librarian had to know exactly what was inside the library and where it was. They cataloged in medieval monasteries, not in the Geniza. And so the process of unpacking everything in the Geniza is ongoing. It's taken over a century, and I don't want to play around with the computer now. Please look at the end of the source sheet. Look at this link. I urge you to go on this website and look at the Schechter Taylor collection, online connection. This is a collaboration between the University of Cambridge and the University of Oxford. Because remember I talked about his nemesis Taylor I don't remember his first name, but he's at the University of Oxford. He ended up publishing some texts on the Geniza. And what this online collection has done is it enables anybody who wants to look at high-quality digital photographs of almost, they're still in the process of digitizing, it's an ongoing thing, but almost every document found in the Geniza, you could zoom in, you could look at a letter that Maimonides wrote. I'm not saying a letter, I'm saying a letter of a word. A letter. You could look at a letter written in the 12th century. This is... I'm a professor. My job is to teach people, and I'm at a loss for words when I talk about the Geniza. But the important thing about the Geniza, and then if we have time, I'll do the other sources. The important thing about the Geniza is, in my mind, that it's overshadowed by the Dead Sea Scrolls. And that was the worst thing to happen to the Geniza. In 1948, 11 caves were discovered that all contained ancient fragments dating to the 1st century BCE and 1st century CE. These caves were near an archaeological site known as Qumran on the northwestern corner of the Dead Sea. The fragments found primarily in Cave 4 number about 900 fragments. And scholars do think that this was a library that belonged to a community of very devout sectarian Jews, probably known as the Essenes, but not all scholars think that. But definitely a sectarian community that withdrew from the broader Jewish life at Jerusalem. They were anti the Jerusalem temple. They felt that the people administrating the temple were very corrupt. They withdrew from Jerusalem. They built this community at Qumran. And the texts discovered in the Dead Sea Caves, that was their library. So everybody knows about the Dead Sea Scrolls. The Dead Sea Scrolls are, you know, super cool and fascinating. Look at these ancient texts. They're almost 2,000 years old. But the issue that I have is that these texts are representative of a tiny sliver of the Jewish population in the late Second Temple period. These were Jews who said, you cannot go to the bathroom on Shabbat. Should I say that again? Do you understand that? I mean, this is not something that most Jews did. There were so many mikvaot, so many immersion, ritual immersion pools at Qumran, more than any other archaeological site that has been discovered of that comparable size. So these Jews were devout Jews, but they were living a form of Judaism that really was not representative of what I would call proto-rabbinic Pharisaic Judaism, or Sadducean Judaism, or any other sect that was flourishing at this time. So unfortunately, the Geniza is really not part of our, I think, our mainstream 21st century discourse when we talk about Jewish history. But because the Geniza was founded in the 9th century and was in use until the end of the 20th century, you're talking about 1,000 years of documentation, and some of those texts aren't from Egypt. They're from other parts of Europe that somehow, mysteriously, found their way to the Geniza, and scholars don't know how this happened. It must have been a well-known Geniza. I do want to leave time for questions, but I just want to say that very, very recently, I think in 2014, and you can Google this, it's not on your source sheet, on a cave in a on the side of a mountain, on a cliff, a few hundred yards up from the ground, a Geniza was found in Afghanistan. Amazing, right? And there are Genizas, ancient Genizas, that have yet to be discovered. And I think that these Genizas should be regarded with the same serious scholarly investigation as those libraries in monasteries that contained both Jewish and Christian and sometimes even pagan texts for centuries. Any questions? Oh, good. Okay, yes, and then... I'm flexible. I do want to talk a little bit, if I can, about some texts that were found in the Geniza, but... Okay, all right. I'm going to take questions, and then if...
You can ask the questions at the mic. That'd be appreciated.
Oh, okay, great. And I'm going to drink while I... Yeah.
I have a little bit of experience with libraries. And nowadays, libraries aren't treated properly anymore. Books have a lifetime.
Use the mic.
But books have a lifetime, and after a few years, they sell them. But in those days, books were used in were very expensive articles. So what went into a Geniza was simply something that could no longer be used, and it would be missing pages or would be unreadable. And I don't think they really took a lot of time to figure out whether it was, whether it had the name of God in it or whether it was strictly religious or not. If it was written in Hebrew, which again was more of a language of documentation as opposed to just normal Hebrew, they would just say, hey, we don't want to throw this away. But
why not? Why didn't
we don't want to categorize or investigate it too much. Mm-hmm. We want to put it somewhere where, God forbid, we need to look at it again. But it's the principle of the stuff that you want to look at is on the top of the pile, and the stuff underneath just doesn't really matter too much. Mm-hmm. So is there really a sense that this isn't a library? This is just the leftovers, and not to say these aren't valuable leftovers, but everything eventually ends up in the cemetery or the Geniza, however you want to look at it. So it's important information, but should we really be surprised that
No, I don't think we should be surprised. I do not think that this is a library. I do think it is a place where they disposed of Hebrew text. I don't think that they did have intention of returning to these texts because there was no public access to the Geniza. And I'll tell you that Moshe Lavi, who's a professor of early Judaism at the University of Haifa and is an expert in the Geniza, is the one who very vehemently says this has to do with their attitude towards the Hebrew language. So I'm relying on Lavi's scholarship.
I realize they had an attitude towards the Hebrew language. But what I'm saying is the people who are actually boxing up the old stuff were not necessarily people who were reading a lot of Hebrew.
Correct. I don't disagree with that at all. And I don't think, again, it's not a library in the sense of a monastery library. Absolutely not. There was no catalog. There was no archive. It was a place to dispose of Hebrew texts.
And you yeah. might be able to find something, but...
I don't know if they ever actually tried, but yeah, it would have been hard, according to Schachter's description.
Misa fragments exist in libraries all over the world.
Right. I'm going to get to that.
There's a Toronto philanthropist, mm-hmm. by the name of Albert Freeberg, who has managed, as a group of scholars working, it's called the Freeberg
yes.
Project.
Right.
And they have acquired by now just about every library, pictures of every library.
That's the link that I gave you. I don't know what that is.
So Professor Gotang, who was, used to use the Gneisa for economic history
right.
of the area, like you mentioned, he was
going to the washroom. Say that again? He was going to the washroom?
He was looking for a washroom.
Okay.
He's looking for a washroom.
Goetheim is the foremost scholar of the Gneisa and did the most work on it in the middle of the 20th century. He devoted his life to the Gneisa.
So he's looking for a washroom, and there's an old secretary, and she says to him, I know what you're looking for, professor. And she directs him to a few cases, or whatever you want to call it, of Gneisa fragments that got lost and they forgot about.
This so is in Ben Ezra? In the synagogue?
No, in Cambridge.
Oh, okay, yeah.
In Cambridge.
Right. Like the Dead Sea Scrolls, many texts have come to light only in the past few decades. This just happened with tefillin, by the way, that were in the basement of the Israel Museum, found in the Dead Sea Caves, that nobody knew about. And now Yonatan Adler at the Hebrew University, a very young scholar, my age, I mean, in his low 30s, was snooping around looking for something else, and he came across these unlabeled boxes. He opens them up. These are tefillin that were never published, never discussed, that were found in the Dead Sea Caves. The same thing has happened with the Gneisa, where you're dealing with 250,000 fragments. Things are not going to be cataloged in an organized way necessarily, but I didn't know that story.
And those tefillin are different than ours.
Yes, they are, and there's some interesting scholarship on that. There's a new article, and Larry Schiffman at NYU has written about this, the tefillin, what was on the tefillin, the Decalogue, the Shema. There was something else I wanted to say. It just slipped my mind, so I'll take another question.
Last question.
Okay, please.
I just wondered, I believe recently there was a history, a sort of a popular history of the Gneisa that was
published. Sacred Trash. It's a good book, although I did find a little bit of contradictory material, but... I emailed the author, and she's very nice about it. Overall, it's a good book.
The author is?
It's a dual author, Adina. What's her last name? You just Google Sacred Trash, Adina. I don't remember her last name. She co-authored it with someone. There's a better book by a British scholar with a less catchy title. Feel free to email me, and I'll send you both of those books. I have them. I won't send you the books. I'll send you the titles of the books. I'm not that nice. But yeah, there's actually a better book that's been put out very recently. Again, it's not coming to me. But yeah, I mean, this is a topic of real interest. All right, well, thank you very much for coming. And please do scan the rest of the source sheet, because I give you a little bit of a tasting menu of the kinds of documents that were found in the Gneisa.